Welcome to Editor's Edition. I'm Jeff Lagerquist with Yahoo Finance Canada. Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream, Greenpeace, and about 500 environmental groups want Canada and the U.S. to stop investing in carbon capture technology. It promises to stop emissions from entering the atmosphere by collecting them at the source, places like oil sands refineries and cement factories. But these groups say this does nothing to stop the root causes of climate change and actually hinders the transition away from fossil fuels. We'll also talk about an out-of-this-world idea from the world's richest man. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos says we should just move polluting industries into space. Is this a far-out fantasy or the kind of bold thinking we really need right now? Joining me to break it all down is Tom Rand, author of the book Climate Capitalism. Welcome, Tom.
Good to be here.
So carbon capture sounds like a silver bullet for fighting climate change, especially for countries that produce oil that we'll need in the near term throughout the transition. Maybe the best place to start is how does this actually work?
Well, the theory is fairly simple. You grab carbon dioxide out of a smokestack before it goes into the atmosphere, and you separate it from the rest of the flue gas, and you compress it, and then you store it. Typically, you store it deep underground, the kind of places that oil come from. From in theory, you can render carbon-intensive factories, power plants, so on, carbon neutral. That's the theory.
Okay, so this is not a new technology, but it's like kind of just starting to take off now. Why is that? Is this the matter of the cost coming down?
No, I think it's beginning to take off because industries that pollute are finally beginning to take their role and their responsibility seriously, and they have an existential crisis. And they're looking for technological magic bullets to get out of this problem. I've argued before, following the arguments of Vaclav Smil, that the idea that we're going to sequester all of our carbon dioxide coming out of all of our stacks and stick it underground, it's a pipe dream. The scale of, for example, just one quarter of point sources in North America, you would have to build the equivalent physical system to handle the mass equivalent of the entire world's oil supply. So it's an absolutely gargantuan task, and I think it's infeasible as a magic bullet. Although I do think there are targeted and necessary interventions that CCS, as it's known, carbon sequestration storage, is actually very useful and much needed.
So the letter that I referenced earlier does take a very hardline stance on CCUS. It calls it a dangerous distraction, and it goes on to say that we need to ditch fossil fuels and not, help these companies fix their emissions problems. Perhaps unsurprisingly, we've seen the oil majors like Shell unveil plans for carbon capture projects. Is it right to frame this in a way as an excuse for these companies to and the world, I guess, to just keep burning oil as we've done?
Yeah, as a first pass criticism, I think there's some merit to that. The notion, again, that we're going to solve our problem through CCS is just a pipe dream. It's expensive, it's massive, and it's just not needed in most cases. So, for example, if you think coal energy production in North America is going to get resolved through CCS, it doesn't work. It makes coal more expensive. Coal is already a sunset industry. It can't compete against renewables and storage. So I think that's just a panacea. The notion that oil and gas is somehow saved by CCS also doesn't work because ultimately the emissions come out of your tailpipe. And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about factories. But I think as a blunt instrument of criticism, it misses some of the finer points, right? So steel and cement are very difficult industries to decarbon. CO2 is released as an endemic process of producing cement, which becomes concrete. And so if you're going to decarbon that industry, there's attempts to do it other ways, but we've looked at this for a while at ArcTurn. I don't think you're going to decarbon cement, for example. And so you need carbon sequestration there. Steel is difficult. You can make steel in theory decarbonate using hydrogen. It's expensive, it's difficult. I don't think you're going to decarbon steel around most of the world. And so you need carbon sequestration. So I think there are targeted industries that need carbon sequestration, A. B, when you look to develop the developing world, coal is not a sunset industry there, unfortunately. It is in North America. When you look at Indonesia, China, those kinds of places, India, they're not going to shut off coal plants that they just built. And so you do need an interim gap. You need that 25-year period where you can sequester that carbon. I think that is needed. So the idea that Canada could develop it, I think that's okay. Is it a panacea and solves all problems? No. Is it required in target industries in the developed world? Yes. Is it required in the developing world? Yes. So let's not pretend it's an answer for Canada, but I think it is something that needs a more nuanced approach than just pushing it aside. I'm sympathetic to that argument. I don't like the notion that people can point to carbon sequestration and say, we'll get to this later. Let me continue with my business as usual. That doesn't work. And so there is some credibility issues there that we need to resolve. And so it's a little more nuanced than the critics would have it.
Okay. I want to talk specifically about Canada. When we look at the last federal budget, there was quite a mixed bag of spending priorities linked to climate. Is this a situation where we need to be throwing resources at every technology we have at our disposal? Or does the government need to refine its spending approach and really, back some clear winners here?
Yeah, look, in one sense, all hands on deck. This is an emergency, right? We've just got news that the conveyor in the ocean is starting to show weakness. So this is more catastrophic than we think, and we need to solve this problem fast. I mean, in terms of our government throwing lots of money at CCS, look, I don't know why the oil industry needs a helping hand financially with this, right? The oil price goes up and down. They have enormous amounts of dividends. They have enormous access to capital. I don't think it's an industry that needs to suck up scarce resources at the federal level on technological development. So I just think the incumbents are trying to grab, and it's called policy capture. They finally realize that climate is serious, the federal government is serious, and so they're putting their elbows up, and they're trying to capture the policy efforts in that area. And I find that to be unhelpful, because there are enormous numbers of emerging industries that don't have their balance sheets, their access to capital, nor 20 years of profits they could have stuck away to try to solve this problem, right? So I feel it's disingenuous for the incumbents to grab billions of dollars of scarce resources targeting this problem.
And I think it's worth noting at this point that we've seen strong financial performance from a number of oil companies in Canada and around the world as we sort of reemerge from the COVID-19 lockdowns, and we've seen the price of oil rebound. So I guess it's, it's tough to, you know, hike your dividends and everything while asking for support from the federal government for these, what are probably very expensive projects.
Yeah, look, if what Canada was doing was saying we're targeting coal and cement, coal in the developing world, and we're looking at, you know, steel and cement, that's fine. So I think, again, there's a nuanced answer here. So if the question is, are the incumbents trying to grab policy? Yes, they are. I find it disingenuous. I don't think the oil and gas sector needs our money, frankly. They never have. There are emerging industries that are not yet massive that do require a leg up. And so I think those scarce resources are misallocated. If we're targeting moving capital, finding ways to stimulate the movement of capital, for example, if you price carbon at $100 a ton, there is no need for federal funding to get those plants off the ground. The cost of that, of emitting that carbon, is sufficient to build those plants. So I think there's more nuance to this policy. And I think if you're looking at the best ways to ignite that industry, put a price on carbon and let the balance sheets of the oil and gas companies handle it. That's what they're good at, building big facilities.
All right, let's stick with controversial ideas and bold thoughts about technology. Jeff Bezos voiced a big one when he got back from his recent space flight. Let's hear a clip of the Amazon founder and the world's richest man.
If you think about it, we are the humanity. We're big now. The Earth is small. It's fragile. In fact, one of the things you see from space so clearly is just how fragile this planet is. Think about the air that we're breathing and this atmosphere. It feels big to us, but it's actually, when you get into space and you can see the Earth's atmosphere, it's so thin and fragile looking. So we do have to take care of this planet. This sounds fantastical, what I'm about to tell you, but it will happen. We can move all heavy industry and all polluting industry off of Earth and operate it in space.
So Tom, a lot of people have chalked this up to what they call the overview effect. When you go out to space and observe the Earth from space, you realize how fragile and delicate and beautiful this place we call home actually is. Back here on Earth, though, does this idea have any merit in your view?
Well, the Earth is fragile, and I'm glad Jeff understands that. But the notion that we're moving heavy industry into space in any time to deal with climate risk, one of the stupidest things I've ever heard. Frankly, it's astounding to me that someone so successful can be so misinformed about the nature of the industries that we need to tackle and the time frame over which we need to tackle them. Again, I'll repeat this. Steel and cement are the two most difficult industries we have to decarbon. That, you're going to build 50 space elevators, maybe 200 years we can do this. We have 15 years left, maybe 20 years to get to net zero. We are not going to move these industries into space. We need to price carbon, and we need to get economic activity on Earth going after those industries. It's not rocket science, quite frankly, quite literally. And so the notion that a space exploration company is going to suggest we move heavy industry to space in time to solve climate risk is bizarre and is stupid and is misinformed, frankly.
So, you know, we were just talking about carbon capture and now this. These are bold ideas. Is there a risk here that when people hear, you know, a guy like Jeff Bezos with a lot of resources at his disposal and certainly a very clever guy in a lot of respects saying these things, that we sort of fall back on this idea that technology will just solve this problem for us? Like, why should I bother changing my behavior if this world's richest guy is just going to move all this nasty pollution to space eventually?
Yeah, that's why I think it's a stupid, it should be called up for what it is, one of the stupidest things I've ever heard. And it is a dangerous distraction. Look, I am a techno-optimist. You know, I love Silicon Valley. You know, I think Bezos has done great things. There's lots of smart people building technologies and all the rest of it. But you can't replace the wheat fields of Kansas in a 4-degree world with, you know, hypersonic or hydroponic greenhouses on top of buildings and cities. You cannot move cement, which is a highly distributed, it's a heavy, heavy, heavy industry all over the world, into space in the next 15 or 20 years. And it's a distraction. The notion that we have technological magic bullets to solve this problem has been a distraction, either explicit or implicit, in our discussion about climate for the past 30 years. If you think technology is enough to solve this problem, I give you the Humble heat pump. The Humble heat pump is a cheaper, more efficient, and better way to heat and cool every building on this planet, pretty much every building on this planet. The heat pump is not installed. It's in less than 5% of buildings in North America. There's a reason for that, because there are social, there are financial, there are policy, there are regulatory, there's all kinds of friction in the market that does not adopt technology tomorrow. This is Vaclav Smil has written a plethora of books around this. Just because you can invent something doesn't mean it gets deployed in infrastructure at a time frame that you can build a new app and disrupt the taxi industry, right? And so again, yeah, I do think it's a distraction. I do think it's a kind of utopianism, techno-utopianism, and it's been a distraction for a while. We have hard work to do here on Earth. I think we should get on with it. And it isn't about inventing new things. It's nice to invent new things. I'm all for it. That's what ArcTurn does. We bring new technologies to market. But we have an enormous amount of emissions reductions we could get after today with existing technologies, with smart, focused, non-intrusive regulatory and policy frameworks. It's boring. It's not what people want to think about, building codes and all that crap, but that's what we need. That's where the work is. The work is not in designing a spaceship to take steel industry into space. That's a nonsense.
So we should be thinking about small things like heat pumps and little incremental things that we can do to sort of gain ground in the climate battle, not just blasting off into space then.
There's big things and there's little things, but the notion that we're going to invent our way out of this with magic bullets is a dangerous distraction, and it represents a techno-utopianism that I think is dangerously false and hubristic.
So Jeff Bezos has you know, backed a lot of companies in clean tech and other sectors looking at fighting climate change, and I believe has done a lot of good work there that is unrelated to space. Does reputation matter here? I know that Amazon has faced all sorts of various types of backlash, from its environmental footprint to the way its workers are treated. Does that matter when we're listening to these people, you know, prognosticate about what we ought to be doing?
Yeah, I'm not criticizing Amazon. I think Amazon does lots of good work. They're buying electric cars from Rivian. And yeah, so I'm not criticizing Amazon. I'm not criticizing billionaires in general. What I am criticizing is non-experts who have a massive soapbox who can move the needle with an intelligent engagement on this issue, throwing out trite observations when they're giddy from coming back from a, you know, $100 million space flight. It's not helpful. It's not useful. I think he should think a little more before he opines on such important subjects. He's a smart guy. That's why I'm so surprised it came out of his mouth. But look, he came back from space. He was giddy. You know, he saw the future 500 years from now. That's nice. We have work to do over the next 10 or 15 years. Those statements are unhelpful. I'm not criticizing Amazon. I'm criticizing that statement.
I can only imagine what I'd be telling you if I was fresh off of space and somebody stuck a microphone in my face. I have no idea. Let's shift gears a little bit to an idea that I know Jeff Bezos and another rich guy, Bill Gates, has got behind. It's the challenge of cheaply storing big amounts of energy on the power grid when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing. It's a challenge that's receiving a lot of attention these days, from hydrogen to iron batteries to thermal storage and compressed air. A lot of companies say they have the answer here when it comes to grid-level storage, but certainly not all of these technologies are going to survive. Tom, one of your clean tech investor peers said that there's an explosion going on in storage technology. How do we sort of separate the winners from the losers here, just given how many people are working to do this?
Yeah, the market's going to separate the winners from the users. That's what the market is very good at. So if you have a need in the market and you have intelligent economic signals to provide value in providing energy storage, the market will separate the winners from the losers. Now, I've got my own view of how you pick them in advance. We invested in HydroStore, as you say. There are reasons for that, right? I mean, HydroStore is not like a battery. It's a very large system. These are capable of, you know, they're gigawatts in size. 5 gigawatt hours, roughly, are the systems we're looking at building in California. That's big enough to take a nuclear plant most of the night, right? These are big utility scale systems. The reason I think HydroStore is so interesting is cost. It's very, very low cost. But more importantly, its supply chain is oil and gas, compressors, expanders, mining industry. So they mine caverns underground to store the air and the water. So they are leveraging very deep, very rich, and very long-standing industries and technologies, which means when they build something for a utility, that utility has a great deal of comfort in will that system operate for a long period of time, 20, 25 years. This is what Silicon Valley got wrong 10 years ago. They thought they could invent new machines and those machines could be deployed as energy storage devices and so on. Utilities don't like new things. They like old things. So here we've got a bunch of old things, you know, old dogs doing a new trick, right? Oil and gas equipment, mining techniques, producing something new, which is a way to store energy. So I think that's it's profoundly interesting from the utility perspective. The other reason I think it's interesting is I'm interested in technologies that can scale up by orders of magnitude in a decade, right? We have, again, I'll repeat this. We have 10, 15, 20 years to solve this problem. So you need to find technologies that you can order 5 of them. So HydroStore is very successful as a company. We make lots of money when they have 4 or 5 systems built, right? They're a few billion dollars worth of value there. The Earth solves its problem when we deploy 1,000 of these systems. So how is it that you can build 1,000 of these? Well, that supply chain is well established. It services the oil and gas sector. It services the mining sector. So when utilities suddenly realize, I'd like a HydroStore, please, you don't have to build a factory that makes batteries, that needs mines to feed it, and then the batteries are built, and then you deploy. There's a whole supply chain manufacturing, you know, set of links you need to build up over time. You can't press a button and increase the scale of that solution by 2 or 3 orders of magnitude in a decade. It's impossible. You can with a HydroStore. We call it systemic innovation, right? Using existing technologies, existing supply chains, and doing things in a new way, leveraging that base of technology. And that's why I think HydroStore is profoundly interesting.
So I should mention that HydroStore is the Toronto-based company that uses compressed air to store energy, and you're deeply involved with them. I believe you're on their board and invested through Arcturn. With so many, I'm just wondering, did you sort of kick the tires of some other technology? I read in the Wall Street Journal about an iron battery that sort of uses like oxidation and stuff, and they said that, well, iron is one of the most abundant sources, elements in the world, and you know, these batteries are very cheap to produce. Did you tell me about some of the other things you might have considered before placing a bet on HydroStore?
Yeah, well, we placed our bet on HydroStore some time ago. We first invested probably 10 years ago. So at that time, the bet was there is not yet a need for long duration storage. There will be a need for long duration storage, and by long duration storage, I mean 8 to 12 hours, right? Not the 4 hours that lithium ion batteries are so good at delivering. When you get that 8 or 12 hours, lithium can't compete with something like a hydrostore. And so anticipating that market is what we did. Now, it takes a long time before these technologies are mature enough and big enough to be commercially ready for prime time. Now, I love Form. I wish Form all the success in the world. Are they going to be in market bidding on 5 gigawatt hour projects in the next 5 years? Not a chance. Like, they have an enormous amount of work to do scaling up manufacturing and robustness and so on. And don't forget, when you're selling to a utility, these big, big systems, like this is as big as Niagara Falls, right? You have to convince the utility it's going to work for 25 years. That's an enormous amount of work from an engineering perspective, an insurance perspective, a partner and supply perspective. It's a non-trivial task to convince a banker and a utility that the system you're going to build will operate for a long, long period of time. Never mind building the capacity to build that system. So yeah, I think 5 years from now, there's going to be lots of other technologies in play. I hope Form does really well. Form's going to be really good at 100-hour storage, which is what they seem to be targeting, because its low power, high energy ratio seems to be embedded into that chemistry. There's a lot of other battery chemistries. We haven't really played in the battery chemistry space yet, because it's difficult. You'll never know what's coming out of MIT. And it's very difficult to get in early. We do have our eye on one. It's called E-Zinc. It's a Canadian company that deploys zinc. It's similar to Form. Form is iron and air. They are zinc and air. And they're simpler. They're easier to scale, and they're probably more ready for prime time, although they're still early. So there's lots of different ways of doing this stuff. I think there'll be a number of energy storage solutions in play 5 or 10 years from now. There's very few that are in play today. Hydrostore has been working on this for 10 years. And so they do have a lead. We're going to take advantage of that lead. And I think they have a very good chance at being the low-cost utility-scale solution. I mean, it's a battery made out of air, rock, and water, right? What could be simpler than that?
So, like you say, this stuff is on a huge scale, bigger than industry. We're talking grid-level applications here. And so a lot of the companies in this space seem to be relatively small, sort of raising financing through venture capital or getting money through Business Development Canada, things like that. What I've always wondered is, why don't we see like the biggest engineering firms in the world sort of taking over this space? Like, why is it the small, nimble startups that are doing this? You would think that, like, you know, Siemens or GE or somebody with, you know, a huge, immense balance sheet would be able to rush in here and take over. Or are these companies active in the space and I just don't know about it?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. First of all, the incumbents aren't very good at innovation. That's not what they do, right? They are very good at leveraging what they've got and selling more of it, right? That's why it's hard for an oil and gas company to become an energy company. They're just not good at that new thing, not good at innovation. Some more so than others, but that's generally the case. Now, there are exceptions. No, Siemens does have a grid-scale energy storage solution they're trying to bring to market. It's based on thermodynamics, hot rocks. Very inefficient. We don't think it competes. It's an internal project that seems to have been spun up. But there are big, big players now positioning themselves in this space. I mean, Hydrostore has a partner called Meridiam, which is a big infrastructure fund out of France, who is underwriting these massive projects in California, for example. We've been working with Meridiam now for 3 or 4 years. We have AECOM, a massive engineering firm out of Houston, Texas, that is our partner when we bid on these projects. So when Hydrostore bids on a project in California, it's a $800 million project, 5 gigawatt hours, it's not Hydrostore. It's a consortium of very large players, developers like Pattern or Gravity, EPCs and engineering companies like AECOM, finance backers like Meridiam. So we do have some big dance partners, and, you know, watch the space. There's some much bigger dance partners coming onto the dance floor fairly soon. So there is a lot of interest in the space. The big players are coming in, and what they're doing is they're looking around and saying, who's got something innovative that we can help bring to market? And that's what venture capital does, gets companies ready to be able to partner and dance with these very much larger partners. And that's the position Hydrostore is at today, and they continue to make progress there.
So at the end of the day, what's going to move the needle for these companies? Is it going to be buy-in from utilities? What are the market forces at play, and how do the economics of all of this sort of shake out?
Yeah, really good question. So for utility scale, so Hydrostore is not batteries going after a megawatt or two, you know, in a factory. These are 500 megawatts and up, 8 hours and up. Like I say, big as Niagara Falls. And so their customers are primarily going to be utilities. And utilities are looking to things like Hydrostore to solve problems they have today. So if you look in California, there's a couple of projects under development. It can be used, for example, in the short term to defer transmission. So right now in the LA basin, they can't shove in more power. And to sort of feed that demand, they could build a new transmission line and more production far away and, you know, pay for that transmission line, pay for the substations. Or you could position a hydrostore system right around that substation and you can kind of arbitrage power from night to day and feed into LA. So that's a short-term need that utilities have that solves an economic problem they have today. And then over the longer term, of course, the reason this is so interesting is there's no ceiling to solar and wind once you've got a bunch of hydrostore systems on the grid. You can put all the solar and all the wind you want, and it's useful because you can store it. That's what's happening in Australia. So Australia has a project called Broken Hills, and they have a feeder line, and it's unstable. There's an enormous amount of solar on there, and then they're looking for solutions today that can use that solar and wind and become useful and firm up that solar and wind. So it's like a baseload kind of power. And that's what they're doing today. And they compete. They are directly competitive on an economic basis with natural gas. And they can compete head to head. And so it's a cheaper solution than a new natural gas plant. And that's why hydrostore brings economic value today. And they do it to utilities who are solving particular problems that utilities have, either on the production side or on the distribution side.
Utilities, I imagine, are quite adverse to risk when it comes to new technologies. Do you imagine this is going to be a big challenge, sort of selling these ideas to public utilities who probably don't want, like, I mean, if you know, for whatever reason, a new technology doesn't pan out exactly the way its backers claimed, I don't think that a public utility is ever really going to want to be holding the bag. Is that a big challenge? And is that changing at all? Are they becoming more willing to engage with startup level companies and things like that?
They're not going to engage with startup level companies at grid scale stuff. They want to see it being done before. And so again, a lot of the unsexy work that Hydrostore has been doing, among others, but Hydrostore is, again, early in the game, and it's much closer to commercialization than others. And you can see these others coming, right? Because you can't get into this market without being seen. These are big projects. These are substantial kinds of technologies. And the unsexy work, and it's been done 3 or 4 years, is to actually bring the partners to the table that de-risk it for the utility, right? So when we build a system in California, the utility has faith that that system will work. We've got operating demonstration facilities of a relevant scale that we've been building over the last number of years. We have partners on the engineering side, on the mining and underground, the geotechnical side, who are bringing their balance sheet to bear. So again, it's not Hydrostore saying to the utility, I'm gonna build you an $800 million system that will work. It's Hydrostore with their partners, big engineering partners, big financial partners, and big mining partners, and big energy equipment supply partners, who are together saying, this will work. Now, you can't build those relationships overnight. You have to work with those big partners for years before they are willing to enter into that kind of relationship with you to go to the utility and say, it's us as a group who are telling you this system we're going to build for you will work. And that's exactly the point that Hydrostore is at today. And what happens is once we build our first massive scale one that is hooked up to the grid and operating, then the dominoes fall. And again, then the question is, how many Hydrostore plants can you build in the next decade? Can you build 1,000? The answer is yes, because we're leveraging a supply chain that's ready to scale in that kind of time frame. We're not building new factories and new mines to find lithium and all that kind of stuff. So things are going to start to get really interesting in the next couple of years.
Well, I'll certainly be watching to see who wins the race to build the biggest, best battery to serve these big, giant needs. Tom, that feels like a good place to end for today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Happy to do it. Always a pleasure.
All right. For all the latest news on clean energy and the broader world of Canadian finance, please visit the Yahoo Finance Canada websites. I'm Jeff Lagerquist. See you next time.